Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is Brian O'Neill, an independent writer, Catholic journalist whose work has been featured in publications such as the National Catholic Register and Catholic World Report, and the current director of communications for the Diocese of Santa Rosa. Brian has appeared several times on our podcast talking about Catholic saints, as he is the author of several books on that topic, including 39 Saints You Should Know, Saint Who? 39 Holy Unknowns, and 150 North American Martyrs You Should Know. All of these excellent works will be linked on our website. Last year, we had Brian talking about several saints who had festival days in January, and I figured this year we'd do the saints of February, because there is one saint who most of the guys out there had better know about in the coming week. Nudge, nudge. Brian, welcome back to Research on Religion.
It is a wonderful thing to be with you back with you, Tony. Thank you for having me.
I have to note for our audience that we are recording this on February 2nd, which is the day after the Seattle Seahawks lost to the New England Patriots in the Super Bowl, and it's also 2 weeks and one day after the Green Bay Packers lost to the Seattle Seahawks in the NFC Championship game. And being that I'm a Seahawks fan and that Brian is not only a Packers fan, but an owner of the
there
team,
yep.
I have to ask this. Is there a saint of broken hearts, or at least of a saint of bad play calling?
Well, I think, you know, I don't know about broken hearts, but there is, you know, let's just pray for Pete Carroll and St. Peter. St. Peter, pray for us. All the St. Peters out there, pray for us. All the St. Charles, you know, because Carroll is a form of Charles, so all of St. Charles is out there, pray for us.
Yeah, no, there needs to be a lot of praying there, because one of the things is that we passed when we should have run, and I know that the Packers a couple weeks ago ran when they should have passed, so it just seems to, I don't know, fate was not with the NFC this year, I guess.
I guess not.
Well, anyways, the last time we talked, you were living out east, but now you're here on the Wild West Coast, just a wee bit south of me, down in California. And you have a new position as communications director for the Diocese of Santa Rosa. Fill us in on how you landed that job and what that job entails.
I was told God's providence. I had been doing a freelance article on a priest who was murdered here on January 1st, 2014, sorry. And so I was doing an article on that for Catholic World Report. I was trying to get in touch with the bishop about it, and while I was on hold, was looking on the website, saw that they had an opening, talked with the vicar general about that. He said, get in the resume. 2 weeks later, I had a phone interview. 2 weeks after that, they flew me out. 2 weeks after that, they offered me the job, and roughly two or more weeks after that, I started the position. So it's been a great gig. I you know, as I've often said to people, I can't believe they're paying me for this. To which my boss said, "Well, you know, we could we can arrange something on that line."
Yeah.
But no, it's fantastic, and I work for a great bishop. His name is Robert Vasha, and you know, very, very humble, good servant of the church and her teachings.
So, what does a communications director for a diocese do? This is the first time that I've heard that they have communications directors, but I guess I shouldn't be surprised by that. It's a diocese and an archdiocese too. They're very large entities, and lots of stuff goes on, and so they probably have connections with the media. So what is your day-to-day job like?
Most of my time is taken up working on the newspaper. We have a monthly newspaper. It typically runs about 24 pages, and you know, I took us transitioned us from this kind of boilerplate one article per month magazine that was being produced for us by a company out of Michigan into our own fully self-produced newspaper. And then after that, you know, I did time, spend time helping the bishop create his blog, helping him communicate his message to both internal and external audiences. You know, I helped keep up with the website, helped do our social media, and basically just do whatever I can to help get the church, her teachings, and her message out there.
So are there any particular issues or stories that you've been dealing with, or does it change on a daily basis?
It changes. I mean, you know, so for instance, the day that I finish, I put the one issue to bed, I'm working on the one thereafter. And so it could be, you know, I'm thinking, all right, this is going to be our cover story for next month. And then, you know, before I know it, the bishop will come to me, and the next thing I know, I should say, the bishop comes to me and he says, oh, okay, well, here's what I want us to do. Or, you know, the Pope does something and, you know, that's not expected. Gee, imagine that with this Pope. And, you know, the next thing I know, we're off to the races in a totally different direction.
Yeah, I want to save a little bit of time at the end to ask you about your perceptions of the Pope, because he is a media-savvy guy and a media surprise guy in many ways, too. And does the Pope make statements, and then all of a sudden they come to your bishop and they say, Bishop at Santa Rosa, what's going on here? And you have to scurry around to put together a news release or something?
We don't ever have to do that. A lot of times, I mean, if anything, what happens is that a local reporter will be looking, you know, they'll be taking an article off of the AP Wire, and they'll want a local angle on it. So they'll ask the bishop for his take, or just some people will take, you know, so for instance, the Pope's famous or infamous, depending on your perspective, comment, who am I to judge? You know, a lot of people who are of a certain theological bent will take that and say, well, look, if he's not judging, why are you not opening masses to this audience or another? And it's just, you know, so it makes the job interesting, to say the least.
Yeah, he also had that statement on dogs going to heaven, and a few podcasts back we asked.
Actually, he never said.
That's what we found out. Yeah, that's what we found out. But I did some research for a podcast that we had a few weeks ago, and I found out that Luther said that dogs go to heaven. So I'm okay being Protestant, and my dog is Protestant. So I think we're okay there. Anyways, less talk about dogs going to heaven and more talk about the saints, because this is your wheelhouse, and you've written three really great books about it. And as I mentioned, we're going to link to those up on our website. And on the previous podcast that we've had you on, you did a really good job covering how various people become saints and how various saints get associated with specific dates, as well as the differences between what we call saints and what we call blesseds. And we're going to point folks back to those fine discussions so they can get a full coverage of that. But if you could just give us a quick reminder of the difference between saints and blesseds, that would help me out a lot.
Sure. Now, and it's a great question, because really, unless you study these things like me, why would you even bother with the distinction? It's just more confusing than anything else. But it's, in one sense, it's very simple. Both a blessed and a saint is in heaven. There's no question about that. That is an infallible ruling of the church, and you know, you can take it to the bank, sort of thing. The difference is the veneration accorded that person. So, for instance, if there's a saint, their veneration extends to the universal church. So that person is a saint in Zimbabwe, is a saint in Tokyo, is a saint in Toronto, is a saint in Seattle, Albuquerque, wherever. But if it's a blessed, it's typically their veneration is typically reserved to a locale or to a particular order. So, for instance, the saint whose feast is this month, Blessed Christina of Spoleto, she is a saint for the Augustinian order and for Spoleto, Italy. But, you know, her cultus, you know, her the devotion to her doesn't really extend to the Universal Church except insofar as people take her story and really find themselves in it or find that she's a, you know, provides them some sort of spiritual inspiration or comfort.
Okay, well, we'll go with that. And again, we'll point people back to earlier podcasts because you do a spectacular job of not only explaining this in even greater detail than you just did, but also cover a lot of other things about how different saints become associated with different days of the year. And there's lots of saints to be associated with different days of the year. But it is February, and every young and old person alike who has ever been smitten with love could probably tell you that the most important saint day of this month belongs to some guy named Valentine. Now, tell me about this. How does a young cherub-like child clad in diapers running around with a bow and arrow shooting people in the butt with passion potion end up being a saint?
Because the church decided we needed cherubs with angel's wings. And who went around with, no, I'm kidding. Basically, Valentine was one of two people. He was either a bishop from the town of Terni, Italy, which is about 60 miles north, almost due north, slightly northeast of Rome, or he was a Roman priest. And the story is that with the bishop, that he wouldn't stop. The local governor really liked him a lot and didn't want to have to, you know, end up having him become a martyr. But, you know, he wanted Bishop Valentine to be very quiet and not be so hell-bent on holiness. But our Valentine would not stop preaching Christ's death, life, and resurrection. And so they captured him, and they dragged him some 60 miles from Terni to the Eternal City. They tortured him there, and then he was beaten to death on February 14, AD 273, outside the Via Flaminian Gate on the Via Flaminia, and then his corpse was eventually taken back to Terni, you know, some years later. Now, the story of the other Valentine is substantially the same, the one of, who was just a priest. Except that the setting of this story is entirely within Rome. And the other difference is that this Valentine was also arrested for witnessing Christian weddings for soldiers because Emperor Claudius II supposedly had said that no soldiers could, since soldiers who were married couldn't serve and he needed lots of soldiers, you know, therefore anyone caught marrying someone, marrying a soldier to a woman would be, you know, suspect. But in actuality, the whole historical record shows that Claudius very much promoted his soldiers taking women to wife, and that, as they used to put it. So, but to remind these men of their vows and God's love, St. Valentine was said to have cut hearts and sent them to the soldiers out of parchment. And then further additions to the legend say that he cured a blind girl named Julia, and who was the daughter of his jailer Asterius. And Asterius was so blown away by this that he sought baptism for his entire household, which would include Julia. And along the way, reportedly, Valentine falls in love with Julia, and on his last night on earth, he writes her this epistle professing his undying and eternal love, and he signs it "Your Valentine."
Hmm.
So that's how he came to be associated with courtly love. It's unclear as to, you know, what the development of the cultus was in the centuries leading up to, say, the 15th century. But by the 15th century, it was pretty well ensconced. In fact, the oldest Valentine's Day card that we have dates from the 15th century. It was Duke Charles of Orleans, or Orleans as we put it, Orleans, France, wrote his wife in the around that time. But on every, you know, his St. Valentine's remains, his relics, most of them are in a church called Whitefriars in Dublin, Ireland. But his skull and a few other bones are in Rome. And every year on this date, on September 4 or February 14th, by the way, they take them and they specially display them so that anyone coming into the church can view them easily and pray before his relics and whatnot. And it's pretty impressive. They crown them with flowers, and there's roses all around, and it's really neat.
Yeah, that does sound very neat. How did some of his relics end up in Dublin, Ireland? Do you know that?
Well, they were found off of the Via Flaminia, and the Pope at that time, who I believe was Gregory the 16th, gave the vast majority of them to the White Friars, to the Carmelites who staffed White Friars. And so that's how they got there. But there are also, there are some remains in, like I said, Terni, depending on which one you believe is that saint. And then also we have some in Prague and Budapest and other places around Europe as well. But they're not substantial, just, small relics.
The other one, there's the debate between whether it was the bishop or the Roman priest. The Roman priest was also around that time, right? The 3rd century A.D.?
Thereabouts, he was also martyred, and they were both martyred on the Via Flaminia. It's just different locations.
Okay.
Not far from each other, yeah.
Yeah, I want to mention that because that is a period in Christian history before Constantine came around, and so there were a lot of persecutions there. So these guys took a lot of risks, either marrying soldiers if it was against policy or just even being outwardly Christian, had a lot of persecutions right around that time. So again, individuals who are greatly devoted to their faith against all odds is pretty remarkable. And that's usually the story of a lot of these folks here.
Yeah, and speaking of Constantine, there's an interesting connection with the second Valentine, the priest, because he was martyred on the on the same bridge on which Constantine's troops fought Maxentius's troops. Constantine won the battle and thus became the emperor of Rome. And then in several years later, 312 A.D., that led to the ending of persecution of Christians when he established the Edict of Milan, which legalized Christianity.
Okay, well, that is an interesting tale about Valentine, dating back farther than I had anticipated. I thought it would just go to the medieval period, so I learned something here, and that'll help me clue in on what I should be doing on February 14th, and that was my nudge to all the guys. Are you prepped and planned for Valentine's Day? Are you sending something off to your sweetie?
I'm as prepped and planned as I can be, so yeah, I hope everyone's happy.
Yeah, which is basically, let's remember quick to head out to the flower store. Okay, so that's my tale, too. I'm doing this one to remind myself that I have to get some nice things for my wife. But we are also talking about February 14th, and one of the things that I found out in previous podcasts was there are a lot of Catholic saints, and so oftentimes you have to double, if not triple or quadruple up, a number of saints on the same day. And given February 14th, you have a list of favorite saints, and another one actually happens to be martyred on that day in 1937. And here we're talking about none other than Blessed Vicente Villar David. Who is this guy, and why is he important?
He was just a plain old layman, husband, father, just a great guy, basically. And was beloved by his employees. He and his family owned. He's kind of like, if you know the movie It's a Wonderful Life, the main character, George Bailey, has these dreams of going off and being an engineer and doing all these wonderful things, but the family business keeps calling him back into, keeps him grounded in Bedford Falls. It's the same sort of thing, Vicente Villar David wanted to be an engineer. In fact, he designed the first airport in Valencia, Spain. But what he found was that the communists come into power around 1930, and they take away the they take away the power over his power over the plant, but and he ran a ceramics plant with his family, but they allowed him to stay on as a kind of a shop steward and regular employee. But one thing that didn't change was his commitment to the faith and his love for our holy Catholic religion. And because of that, the communists told him to knock it off, and he wouldn't. He would just keep, he just kept on being this really faithful layman. And so what happened was he was arrested, and his kind of kangaroo court trial ended in the early morning hours of February 14, and they condemned him to death. And he said, "Can I at least go home and say goodbye to my wife?" And he was so respected in the community that they allowed him to do that. And so he went back home, and he gave her a hug and a kiss. He didn't tell her what was going to happen, but you know, she sort of suspected it, because as they were parting, and the guards were leading him away, she said, "I'll see you tomorrow, right?" And he said, and he turned back his head back around to her and said, "Tomorrow or in heaven." And about two blocks away, she could hear the gunfire, because they shot him twice in the head. And so as a result, he was martyred on February 14th, back, like you said, in 1946. You know, and to mention, I'm looking at one website. You were saying that there was one, you know, that there are sometimes several saints per day. Here on February 2nd, I'm looking at least 15, maybe 20 saints just for this day.
Wow. Yeah, so three or four, I'm way underestimating it.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah. The interesting story about David, too, is that, you know, this is a reminder, too, that saints are not necessarily the ones who are always the, you know, people who in monasteries or who are priests or anybody like that, but can be just average run-of-the-mill people who have extraordinary faith and extraordinary circumstances. And, you know, here's a guy who is married. And I think a lot of people would be surprised that there's a married saint as, or blessed as early or as late as the 20th century here.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, the Pope just got back on the 22nd of January. The Pope just beatified as a martyr another layman. This was from South Africa. And he was killed by a bunch of people because he was telling them that their recourse to witch doctors and sorcery and whatnot was against God and it was demonic and that they had to stop. But here was another married layman.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it happens even, and this guy died back in 1990. So it happens even in our own day.
Yep. Well, that is a wonderful love story for you know, Vicente Villar David. I mean, it has a very tragic ending, but you know, you can see his passion for God and also his passion for his wife.
Sure.
And you know, February 14th, you know, being a day that we go to extraordinary means to show our love for one another, as did the earlier Valentines. But there are a few others here that romance doesn't turn out necessarily too well, and you sent me the name of the patroness of miserable marriages. This is Blessed Elisabetta Canori Mora.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Is she celebrated on the 15th at miserable marriages after the guys forget the flowers and candy and you're sleeping on the couch? Or when is her saint day and or festival day? And how did she get this designation of patroness of miserable marriages?
She got it because she was in one, and her actually subtract 10 from 15, and that's when you, that's what her feast day is. It's February 5th. What happened was that she married this gentleman named Carlo Mora, and Elisabetta and him were very, very happy at first. You know, he was a up-and-coming lawyer, like I said. He was handsome. She was beautiful. She came, both of them came from very good families. And, it seemed like a very well-made match. But a few years into their marriage, his name wasn't Carlo, it was Cristoforo, Cristoforo kind of grew mentally unstable, and he became very jealous and controlling of her, even though she never gave him cause to be, and even cut off her visits to her own relatives, to her folks, and that sort of thing. And little by little, he began becoming cold and distant and indifferent. And when he wasn't being disengaged from her, he was screaming at her in these outrageous, jealous fits, even though, again, she didn't do anything to deserve it. And soon thereafter, he began cheating on her with a woman of lower social status. So not only was he cheating on her, not only was it with a woman of lower social status, which back then in Rome, where they lived, that was, you know, would have been something really terrible.
What period are we talking about here?
Late 19th century.
Late 19th century, okay.
Yeah, so, you know, I mean, back then, you know, think about Pride and Prejudice, and, I mean, the situation, if you know, if you've read those types of novels from the 19th century, it wouldn't have been too different. You just would never be seen with someone of a lower social class. And then to not only have all this going on, but to have your husband do nothing to hide the fact that he's cavorting with this woman, you know, it was profoundly humiliating for her. And what was even more humiliating is that her husband was made some very bad speculative financial moves, which ended disastrously. His practice was not doing very well. And part of that was because he was kind of dissolute. You know, he didn't mind so much giving himself over to drink and that sort of thing. And as a result, they had to move into his parents' home. And so now she's always under the watchful eye of mother and father-in-law. And the sister-in-laws, are not being very kind. The only thing that's giving her any happiness right at this point, although it also adds to the heaviness of her cross, the two infants that she and Cristoforo had together. And 3 years into her marriage, she has some more joy, and she bears a third child. And so as a result, you know, she's got these three children under the roof of her in-laws. She can't get the normal rhythm of family life going because it's not her home. And you would think that Cristoforo would have looked at this situation, seen how he was at fault, seen how his wife was a superstar who was doing heroic things for him, and come back to her with a repentant heart. Well, you would think wrong, because instead he was inflamed by his pride and humiliated by his failures, and that made him be even worse. And so he treated his wife with contempt as if she was to blame for all of the problems. It was just really, really bad. She became pregnant again in 1801, and she safely delivered the child, but became gravely ill. Through a miraculous intercession of Our Lady, she obtained a healing. But, she just was constantly under the burden of these bad things that I've just been describing. And, she started going to confession more. She started receiving communion more than once a week. Most people didn't even receive once a week back then. It was very rare that people received anything close to a frequent basis. And she also made three resolutions: to be unfailingly meek, to never show anger, to submit to God's will in all things, and thus to perceive all things that happen to her as God's will, and then to do penance and mortification for her husband's conversion. And, still, things were either just as bad or getting worse. In fact, her sisters-in-law openly blamed her for their brother's financial failings and for his adultery, saying, with a different woman, Cristoforo would be different. And then they were pressuring her, the in-laws and her husband were pressuring her to give written consent for her husband's adultery, which, not, understanding that, you can understand why she would say, "It's good for me to have spent 2 hours in prayer today. God gave me so much strength that I was ready to give my life rather than to offend my Lord." After her father-in-law died, she and the girls were kicked out of the family's apartment. So now she has to go find some rundown, flat or apartment or something. But, it's in the worst part of town, and because she has no other way of supporting herself, because her husband's such a bad provider, she has to go earn a living cleaning people's toilets. Now, keep in mind, she's from upper-class nobility. She's probably never done a thing for herself along these lines in her life. Now she's having to make a living of doing this. And when she was 50 years old, she developed dropsy, which is an accumulation of fluid under the skin, and got to a point where she couldn't even get out of bed. I mean, she was always in so much pain. And miraculously, this is what caused Cristoforo to start returning to her. And he was by her side day and night. But on the last night, her last night on Earth, he wasn't there. He had gone to be with his mistress again. And so when he returned at dawn and entered their room, he found her dead. And he just broke down, finally realizing what a terrible cretin he had been. And a few years later, he went on to become a priest. He entered the Franciscans. But as she, I mean, you can see, just a really remarkable woman who never took to backbiting, never took to screaming at her husband. She was just going to be as calm and mental, gentle as she could. And, you know, she's a great model for all those in miserable marriages, to say the least.
Yeah, and it's interesting how, again, then in her death, she turns her husband around, which is miraculous. In many ways, is that how she was brought to the attention of the Vatican, who made her a blessed, or who brings her case forward?
Well, she was a Third Order Trinitarian. The Trinitarians are a order of their order of priests and brothers, you know, kind of like the Dominicans or the I guess any Dominicans or Franciscans or Sulpicians or Salesians, anything like this. And so she, she was a Third Order, which meant that she was a lay person in that order, in cooperating with them. But, her, and if you ever get to Rome, which I hope everyone does, I hope that you get to see where the little tiny church where she's buried, because that is, it's just a very intimate little tomb, and it's pretty neat. But, regardless of that fact, she is, her case was put forward. It probably helped that she was in Rome. And, in any event, I'm not really quite sure who introduced precisely, that's how it probably happened, I'm guessing, is either the Diocese of Rome or the Trinitarian Order put forward the cause. The Trinitarians are the postulators, are the people who are working her beatification, and it was the introduction of her cause was back in 1874, so about 50 years after her death. So, that's about all I can tell you right now.
Yeah, I can imagine how the Trinitarians would just see her on a daily basis, just suffering so, but with the great pleasure of God in her heart, and just make the case for her, as I assume that many of these other folks are. Well, here's our next one. And it is said that beauty is always in the eye of the beholder, and that there is no greater beholder than God himself. And here we have St. Joan de Valais, I believe I pronounced it correctly. And the title here is kind of interesting because she is described as ugly woman in the eyes of men, but beautiful saint in the eyes of God. Now that is quite the description. When is her designated day, and what got her this designation? What's her background?
Well, she was a princess.
Mm.
She was born toward the late middle part of the 15th century, pardon me, and her family name was Valois, which is the family name for all of the French royals that are Bourbon or Capet, but she was of the Valois brand of dynasty, and she was born. People are born, they're so cute, blah, blah, blah. No, she was always ugly, and she was deformed. And her father, King Louis the 11th, was terribly ashamed of her due to her looks. And, dynasties and whatnot being what they were, he had no male heirs. And there was a law, unlike in England, if your only living heir was a girl, you know, like in England, they had Queen Elizabeth I, Queen Mary, these sorts of things. In France, you had to, the throne always went to the husband of the oldest daughter. If there was no male issue, and so King Louis the 11th married her to Duke Louis of Orleans, and is the same guy who we have the Valentine's Day card, interestingly enough.
Mm.
And when this man ascended to the throne, he immediately obtained an annulment of his marriage. So now she's not going to be left a pauper, but she's certainly not, she has no influence, no anything. She's just kind of on her own. So what she did then was she founded a religious order called the Order of the Annunciation. And really her whole story can be summed up in this quote, which is just amazing. "The reason why people despise me is not a valid one. For the value of a person comes not from the beauty of the body, but from the beauty of the soul. I have a value as a princess, a daughter of a king, a wife of a king, and a Catholic. And there is no ugliness that can annul these values. This is part of the moral order. Men can think what they want, judge whatever they desire. I will behave without arrogance, but in full accord with my dignity." So take that. So there.
Nanny, yeah.
Nanny boo-boo. But I mean, isn't that, that's an amazing perspective, because how many of us look around and we say, oh, you know, I'm too fat, I'm too thin, you know, maybe women will say, gosh, my derriere isn't this way, or my bosom isn't this way. People think that they're ugly, that they're too stupid. That means nothing in the eyes of God. What means everything in the eyes of God is who you are as a son or a daughter of God. And none of these other totally insignificant things matter a bit. Your relationship with Him and how holy you're becoming, that's what matters.
It was fascinating that she was around in the late 15th century, probably early 16th century, because we think of that notion as being relatively modern, that, well, you know, everybody should be, you know, roughly the same. We're not going to judge anybody on anybody else, although we do it all the time. It's kind of a consistent throughout history, and,
sure,
and body images are put into our face all the time about how we're supposed to look and how we're supposed to dress, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, even back then, people were looking beyond that and seeing into the soul of this beautiful woman who again, kind of suffered at the hands of jerky men.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, no doubt about it. You, Duke Louis of Orleans, who became King Louis the 10th, or the 12th rather, you know, he only married her because of her position as the daughter of the king, and that he would become king himself after her father's death. And as soon as the crown was on his head, he had their marriage annulled.
Yeah, so guys are not turning out too well right now. So far, the Valentines, the two that we talked about, were pretty good. So we like those. But
and Vicente, I mean, you know, he's a great guy.
Oh, that's true. Yes, we talked about him too. But so there must be some really good, inspirational men out there who have saint days, in addition to the two other guys that we had. And one of your personal favorites is one that we talked about before. And I can't pass this guy up because you convinced me that he should be one of my favorites as well. And give us a very quick lowdown. We'll point people back to the earlier podcast, but briefly fill us in about the life of Blessed Sebastian of Aparicio. And what is he most known for?
He is the very first in the history of the world cowboy.
All right. Yeehaw.
Exactly. Yeehaw.
Yeah. That's why I like this guy. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, and you know, the thing is the guy was, you know, we like to talk about being self-made men and women in this country, and how, you know, if you really want to succeed, all you have to do is pull yourself up by the bootstraps and, you know, put your mind to it and you'll do that. He did. He came to this country, or he came to this hemisphere from Spain with nothing in his pocket, and he soon became a multimillionaire. I mean, relative to today. To today's terms, and as a result, you know, he could have done anything that he wanted to in life, but after being widowed twice and having developed this huge heart for the poor and for indigenous peoples of the area, the Aztecs, etc., he decided to become a Franciscan monk. And his he would ride this circuit, which was 5 hours in circumference from his monastery in Tlaxcala, Mexico, and you would beg alms for both the friars, but also his fellow friars, but also for the poor. And it was an amazing thing that he was so successful in that. I mean, before he was really good at earning money, now he was really good at earning alms. He had to carry, ride on a wagon. He lived into his 90s, and even to this day, his body is incorrupt, or at least parts of it are.
Yeah, it's amazing the story that you tell of him, too, because he would just walk for miles and miles and miles and miles and just trot in bare feet and everything. And I mean, he's a tough old codger.
Yes, he was. And he was doing this in his 80s and 90s.
Yeah.
You know, and people thought he was going to die several times. And he just took a licking and kept on ticking.
Yeah. So we're going to point folks back to that earlier podcast so you can get the full story of that guy. His date, though, is February 26th, his festival day. So remember him on that day. Now, moving on here and talking about perseverance, even folks who are not Catholics and who don't necessarily celebrate the feast days of the saints, you really have to admire the perseverance of people like Aparicio. But here's another person who is just an absolutely heroic figure, and that is Saint Josephine Bakhitat. If I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Actually, it's Bakhitat.
Bakhitat. Bakhitat. Yes. St. Josephine Bakhitat. Who is this remarkable woman?
She's a remarkable woman.
Yeah.
No, in all seriousness, she is she's beyond remarkable. She was born as the daughter of a chief in a village in what we now know as the Darfur region of Sudan. And she was out with a friend walking by some woods one day, and some men jumped out of the woods and told her to go and find something that they had dropped there, and kind of scared but not having any reason to doubt what they were saying because she was this young, innocent girl of about 9 years old. She did so, and when she turned back around, she found the men had followed her in there. They had a knife. They said, if you scream, we're going to kill you. And lead to the beasts, you know, to eat them, to eat you. And so she just kept deadly quiet. And she was kidnapped thereafter, turned into a slave, and was a slave for several decades. In fact, you know, her treatment was so traumatic that she could not remember her own name. Everyone kept took to calling her Bakhita, which in Arabic means lucky. And it was a sarcastic sort of nickname given to her by her slavers. And anyway, what happened then was a Italian diplomat bought her, had heard good things about her, had seen her, and she was finally being treated well by an owner, by one of her masters. He then gave her to an Italian businessman and his wife because they needed a nanny for their daughter. And when they went back to Italy, they took her with them. And there was a point where the husband had to go back to Africa. The wife decided to follow him but did not want to take the girl with her, so she had Josephine stay behind with the daughter. But they were all going to be put up in a local convent. The Kenosian Sisters Convent in Venice. And when they came back, when the mother and father came back to fetch their daughter, they also wanted to bring Josephine along with them, and she refused. She said, no, I'm staying here. I have found my true happiness. She had become a convert in the meantime, you know, in the space of their being gone. And she said, I'm not stepping foot outside of this convent. And so they took her to court. They took the order to court, and they lost in court because Italian law said that you couldn't be a slave you couldn't own slaves in that country. And furthermore, even in Sudan at the time, slavery was illegal. And so her captivity was completely illicit from beginning to end.
Now, what era are we talking about here?
We're talking about in the late 19th, early 20th century.
Wow. Yeah,
all this was happening. And as a result, she became a Kenosian sister. Whenever she would pass by the baptismal font where she was baptized, she would say, and here is, she would hug it, and she would say, here is where I became a daughter of God. Her autobiography in the early 1930s in Italy was a runaway bestseller. It ran through several printings. And it's just an amazing tale of perseverance. But, you can imagine that the Italians at the time weren't that used to seeing black people. In fact, there was one little boy during his first encounter with her, licked her skin because he was trying to get the chocolate off of it.
Mm.
But, soon people came to know her and to love her. She was the portress, which means, she was like the person who watched the door. She would do catechesis with the children. She would just spend hours and hours in prayer. And she always just had this beautiful, radiant smile on her face. And that's one of the reasons why people came to have such a devotion to her. It's one of the reasons why I love her so much, is that she took this terrible situation in which she started life, effectively, and made it into something that glorified God in a truly heroic way, in an extraordinary and exemplary way.
And we are celebrating her saint day on today, which is February 8th. We are recording this on the 2nd, but releasing it on the 8th. And so keep her in mind, the remarkable perseverance. These are all these stories, and this is why I love having you on the show often, is because these stories are just so admirable, and they really inspire you even in your moments of seeming darkness, like a Super Bowl loss, and you realize how meaningless that is in comparison to what some of these individuals went through and became very faithful. And the other thing that's noticed very important about Bakitat as well is that she comes from Africa, is in Italy. So these are people from all around the world, and one of the next saints that you mentioned is the first African-American saint, and that's Saint Josephine. She was from Africa, but here in the United States. And tell us a little bit about her story.
Well, yeah, and actually, she's not a saint yet.
Ah.
She is what they call a servant of God, and that means that her process for canonization has formally been opened. But in any event, She was part of the slavery, descendants of slaves that were brought to Haiti. And when the...
I should just break in here. I just realized I made a mispronunciation here. I was calling her Saint Josephine, the first African-American saint or one to be beatified. It's actually Elizabeth Lang. So I just want to clarify that.
Right. Well, and she had... there is something though to that, because she founded an order, if memory serves correctly, she founded an order of religious women that were called the Sisters of Saint Joseph, and they wore black habits, and they would they wore these very simple white coats, and or not white coats but white caps, because she had been impressed with the Mennonite women that she had encountered in Western Maryland. So, but yeah, she was a free black, and yet she was living during the time of the Civil War, and as a result, she was going around and ministering to slaves and free black people. Her holiness was such that people have become really, really profoundly impressed with her. And actually, I got the name of the order wrong. It's the Oblate Sisters of Providence, not St. Joseph. But, she took Joseph as a religious name, I believe. Her name may have been Josephine at first, but she eventually became... Mother Mary Lane. She took Mary as her religious Lane. name. So in any event, yeah, she's a great story. Black History Month, we have several, we have probably four or five causes going forward for Black American saints. And, you know, it's just, it's neat. It'll be neat one of these days to see some, one of them beatified.
So you mentioned that she is known as Servant of God, and so that's before being a blessed. Is that a special title on the way to sainthood, or I'm a little bit confused there?
Sure. No, when someone, if someone is, let's say Tony Gill dies tomorrow, God forbid, but 5 years from now, people think that he lived a holy enough life that, that we should put forth his cause for beatification. And by the will of God, ultimately canonization. When the Vatican accepts, says, yeah, go ahead and start investigating this, that person, then it would be the servant of God, Dr. Tony Gill. But then, you know, and then they would, after all the material had been put together, the case for the cause had been put together, that would get sent to Rome. People at the Congregation for the Causes of Saints, they would plow through all of that material, and if they agreed that Tony Gill has lived a life of heroic virtue, they would go to the Holy Father, ask him to issue a decree of heroic virtue regarding Tony Gill, and then from thereafter, Tony Gill would be known as the Venerable Tony Gill. Once a miracle was attributed to Tony Gill, then he would, and was confirmed by the Holy Father, and the beatification ceremony took place, then it would be the Blessed Tony Gill, or blessed, just Blessed Tony Gill. And then after another miracle, it would be Saint Tony Gill. So that's sort of how it works.
Okay. So she's right there, kind of at the beginning of the process, and probably moving along in terms of that. One more I want to cover in the time we have remaining, because I want to leave a little bit of time to get your impressions of the new Pope. I've been asking of that of all my Catholic guests. But this guy is kind of interesting, and he has a very interesting title to it. It's Blessed Fray Leopoldo de Alpendari. And he comes with this interesting title, as I mentioned, the Humble Beggar of the Three Hail Marys. And I'm assuming this does not refer to Doug Flutie and his miracles on the gridiron at Boston College. So how does this guy become known as the Humble Beggar of the Three Hail Marys, and how does he make it on the February saint list?
Well, you know, here's another guy that lived within the lifetime of some of the people listening to this podcast. He only died in the 1930s or something. So, you know, he's a pretty remarkable dude. But what happened, he was born in the far southern part of Spain, a region known as Malaga. And what he was just from a simple farming family, and his job in the family was to go out and herd the goats. And, he would be doing this with, you know, the other kids in the village and that sort of thing. And one day when they were out in the field looking after their herds of goats, the sky began to cloud and threaten a storm. And they were debating, these children, about what they should do. Should we make a run for it back home? Should we stay, wait for the storm to pass? And Blessed Leopoldo said, let's go to this rock. We can take refuge there. We'll say a rosary to pray for the protection of the Blessed Virgin. But then another child disagreed, and he said, let's go back to home, get back to town as soon as possible. So finally, all of them moved out, including Blessed Leopoldo. But the march was interrupted by a thunderbolt that struck down the young man who had proposed the hasty return, and he was killed. And so, we don't know if that had any impact on his deciding to become a monk, but at age 35, he tried to enter the Capuchin order. He had been very impressed by their how secluded they were and their holiness, but it took them 5 years for them to accept it. He would try and try and try for them to do so, and they kept saying no until finally in 1899, he was received. He made his final profession in 1900. And after being stationed in Seville, they put him back into Granada, which is kind of around his home area, and he was their almoner. And that meant, you know, just like Blessed Sebastian, he would go around begging alms. He was also the gardener, and everything that he did it as if it was the first time doing it. So he did it with all of his might, in other words. And it's what St. Jose Maria Escrivá talks about, doing ordinary things in an extraordinary way. So whether it was working in the garden and trying to turn that into an act of prayer, or going out and doing the daily work of begging for the convent and for the poor, he was always trying to do something better than he had done the day before. And what's really impressive to me about him is that he got into the Capuchins because he liked their being secluded. And now he's in the Capuchins, and he's out on the dusty streets and in the roads and the valleys and et cetera, and begging for people's ability to give sustenance or to have sustenance. And what he would do when he got when you gave him an alms, he would say three Hail Marys for you. And so people say that he would always, as he was walking, he always had his eyes lifted up to the sky, and he was always praying the rosary. And people just loved him. When he died, the entire city went into mourning. Tens of thousands of people came to his funeral. And to this day, 800,000 people a year, it's estimated, visit his tomb.
Wow.
His pilgrimage is there. That was just incredible. And if you look at his name is Blessed Leopold of Alpendiere, I'm not quite sure how you pronounce it. It's Alpandiere. And if you look at his photo online, you see just what a happy, content, almost radiating holiness type of person that he was.
Well, we'll make sure that we link to one of those photos and maybe include it in our promotional photo that we usually use and put up on Facebook. Because, again, those are the folks that I just really love. And reading your work, you really celebrate and highlight a lot of the ordinary folks who do extraordinary things, which is all these saints. They just do absolutely fantastic things. It's a great remembrance, not only of their lives, but also keeps us to remember the things that we need to do better in our lives as well.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, to be a saint is not difficult in a certain sense, because the formula is very simple. Do everything to your best degree, especially when it comes to serving and worshiping God. You know, in the Mass, halfway is not acceptable. It's because everything in the Mass matters. So, you know, pray the Mass, don't just say the Mass. You know, if you're cleaning the kitchen floor for the umpteenth time this week, do it with, as an act of service to God, that you're cleaning God's floor, that you're cleaning Jesus' floor, or cleaning Jesus' toilet, or doing whatever. It's the little acts that will help us become saints.
That I have to give a hearty amen to that, because that is just such a tremendous lesson. And it also, you know, reminds us to look around us and see the saints in daily lives and really appreciate their actions, not only try to live up to those standards, but, you know, the folks around you who just, you know, are delivering pizzas or helping you, you know, pave your driveway. You know, some of those folks just do extraordinary things. And speaking of folks who do extraordinary things and in very passionate ways, I want to finish off by asking your impressions of the new Pope. Actually, he's not so new. He's been around for about 2 years now. And he's been really shaking things up quite a bit. We've had a few podcasts here recently about the Pope and his relations with the media and his ideas about helping to reform the Curia and all these other different things. But from your seat, where you're sitting now in the Diocese of Santa Rosa and having to deal with some press releases that might be related to him every so often, but also as your seat in the pews on a, you know, weekly basis, how do you view this guy? What's your thoughts on Pope Francis?
He's the most interesting and challenging pontiff of my lifetime. And so it's it's always something where, he challenges me in a good way, both a good way and a bad way. The good way is that he's always causing me to evaluate, am I doing enough for the gospel? Am I doing enough to proclaim with my life and with my words? Because both are important. It can't just be an example. It can't just be words. It has to be both. Am I doing a good job of proclaiming with my life the gospel of Jesus Christ, his life, death, and resurrection? If I'm not, I'm feeling much more compelled to do something on behalf of the poor, on behalf of the lonely, on behalf of people who are in distressed sorts of situations. But then he makes things kind of interesting in another way, in that some of the things that he says, while you can square them with Orthodox Catholic teaching, they're kind of hard to get your mind around, to put it mildly. For instance, when he said, well, who am I to judge? You have to look at that little quotation within the context of what he said. And then the other day when he made the comment, during his trip, rather, to the Philippines and Sri Lanka, on one of his airplane news conferences, he made the comment that, Catholics aren't required to be breed like bunny rabbits. Well, and then the next day it came out that he was surprised that the secular media had taken his quote and taken it out of context and run with it the way that they did. And you just wonder, okay, Holy Father, what are you thinking? I mean, it's obviously going to happen this way. So, he's a very interesting man, but regardless of, I just have, he's a great reminder that we trust in the Holy Spirit to maintain the office, that he's not going to, when he's speaking as a matter of, from, the chair, that he's not going to do anything heretical, and that God is in charge of the church. He's merely God's vicar.
Yeah. No, as you were talking about that, how the media takes many of the things out of context, I just wrapped this around at the beginning when I mentioned his statement about dogs going to heaven, and you were absolutely correct. He didn't really say that. But the media actually said that, or twisted around, and pops up onto my Facebook feed or somewhere else. Somebody mentions this to me, and all of a sudden everybody's talking about that. And he's a guy who really does use rhetoric and fun and odd, strange and controversial, maybe not controversial, but provocative ways, I think. And he's really shaking things up.
Yeah, it keeps us on our toes, that's for sure.
Well, you have a lot of keeping on your toes as the Director of Communications at the Diocese of Santa Rosa, and also doing all your books. And are you writing any more books, I should ask, by the way?
Not right now. I'm taking a little bit of a break from them. They are a tremendous amount of work.
Yeah.
So with not all that great of a, return on the investment.
Yeah. But we really appreciate all that work that you've been doing, and we'll link back to folks who are curious about all these different saints that you bring to our attention, many of the known ones and many of the unknown ones. My guest today has been Brian O'Neill. Brian, thanks for being on Research on Religion again.
Hey, thank you. God bless you. Have a great day, Tony.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.